There's a world out there, you gotta see it, we'll show you how. The planet's at your fingertips, so get out and see it now. There is a whole world right outside your door. So if you've got the world waiting for you, what are you waiting for? Get out and see the world because you can. Because you can. Get out and see the world because you can. There's a whole world waiting for you. What are you waiting for? Life can change, tide can turn, fate can take a twist. But you still have the freedom to travel. Get out and see the world because you can. Get out and see the world because you can.
Good afternoon. This is Cindy Smith with the Freedom to Travel live internet radio show, coming to you every other Sunday at 3:55 p.m. Pacific Time or 6:55 p.m. Eastern. Today we're pre-recording our show, so if you're listening and you want to contact our guest, or if you have any questions regarding this show, feel free to contact me at the website www.freedomtotravelshow.com. Or you can write a comment to me also on the BBS site that you're listening to this program on. I'm the executive producer and the host of a television series called The Freedom to Travel Show. And what this is, it has three themes. I have a guest, that's one, their disability, that's two, and a totally accessible travel destination, that's three, within each show. And I highlight my guests' achievements and attitudes around their disabilities while educating my viewers. This radio program is an extension of it in that we are traveling, but not in the literal sense. Instead, we're traveling deep into our hearts and enhancing our love and connection and understanding of one another. We're taking a journey into a heightened awareness and a new perspective or outlook on issues of disabilities. We are going to create a natural shift in awareness and nourish a part of us that longs to love and be loved. Today, me and Josie Varga, my co-host, are interviewing our guests together. Some of you might recall Josie's interview I had with her on my second show. You can also find that on the internet site, Freedom to Travel Show. Josie is the author of two books and one that we highlighted on the program called Footprints in the Sand. But Josie and I are fascinated by the work of our guest today. Her name is Kathy Snow, and she's not only the author of a book called Disability is Natural, she has several years of public speaking under her belt, including training and consulting work all around issues of disabilities. And you can find more information on Kathy at her website, which is www.disabilityisnatural.com. Kathy personifies our mission with the Freedom to Travel Show in raising awareness without fear. And she has a deep belief that there needs to be new perspectives about disability. In addition to that, Kathy's also a parent of a child with cerebral palsy. So at this time, Josie and I take great pleasure in introducing our lovely and very wise guest, Kathy Snow. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Cindy and Josie.
Hello,
thank
Kathy.
You so much. Hi, Josie, and thank you for that very kind information. I feel like I need to do a tap dance now or something to demonstrate my appreciation.
No, we are appreciative of you and all your work. It's quite amazing. We can't wait to get down to nitty-gritty here and ask you some great questions.
Well, we're not the only ones that feel that way, obviously, because I happen to be poking around on your website, and I looked under rave reviews, and I wanted to mention one comment that you got that really touched my heart. And let me read this. And perhaps you'll remember which one this is. This comes from Tracy from Georgia. And she wrote, "Remember me? I was the one who burst out crying at the end of your presentation. I have seen the light. This has changed my life. My burden has been lifted. I thank God for letting me find a way to you. This has been one of the best experiences of my life. I hope I can see as clearly as you someday. Before your presentation, I felt like I couldn't take it anymore, but you have given me hope. I feel alive again. I am so excited to help create a society in which all are valued and all belong. I didn't want the time with you to end. Kathy, that is absolutely beautiful.
Oh,
do you remember that?
I do.
Wow.
Yes.
And what was that in referral to? Was that one of your many public speaking engagements?
Yes, that was at a presentation I did, you know, quite a long time ago, actually, and I still stay in touch with Tracy every now and then, so, and that's always wonderful. And I do, thankfully, receive a lot of emails that go along that line. I collect them. I need to go back on that page and update it because it hasn't been updated in a while. And at the same time, there are people who feel differently. There are some people who write to me and say, you know, you're from another planet, lady. You don't know what you're talking about. So, you know, so everybody, you know, hears my message or reads it or, you know, visits the website. Everybody, as you all probably well know, sees things or hears things through their own filters. And so some people are ready to hear a new way of thinking, and others want to sort of hold on to the old ways of thinking. And, you know, and also it's a situation, I think, where people that are afraid to move on to new ways of thinking, it's just more comfortable to stay in that rut that we're in.
Mm.
And any kind of change is hard. And I also tell people, though, like Tracy, for example, that people who agree with me, for quote unquote, for lack of a better term, that I tell them, I'm not telling you anything that you probably didn't already know, that's already in your heart, that I just brought it to the surface. I just used, you know, certain words that were meaningful to you and that, you know, freed you up to embrace what you already believed in your heart.
And just to kind of, some of the things you just mentioned, you said for change, and which, we know you wrote Disability is Natural, but I'd like to know, can you kind of give us a little background on that book?
Sure. And that means I have to give you a little background on myself, and you all, you know, feel free to stop me if I'm, you know, going on too long or if you need to, you know, interject something else. But I mean, before my kids were born, I didn't know anything about disability. Like, you know, most people in our society, unless you have some personal experience, you don't really, you know have any knowledge or know anything. And so we had our daughter Emily, and then when she was about a year and a half, 2 years old, then Benjamin came along, and Benjamin was born prematurely, and this is in 1987. So he's 21 years old today, and this is in 1987, and he was premature, and he was diagnosed at the age of 4 months with cerebral palsy. And again, like most parents, I didn't know, you know, what to do. And so I listened to what all the quote-unquote experts told me to do. And by that, I meant at the time I thought that experts were professionals. And so I, you know, they said early intervention and services, and they said physical therapy and occupational therapy and, you know, maybe later speech therapy. So I went into it, you know, gung-ho. And, you know, and they said, therapy 2 times a week. I said, wait a minute, this is my son you're talking about, and I want what's best for him. And I've since realized that my story is very, very universal. I mean, I tell this story when I do presentations, and I see all these parents nodding their heads, yes, they did the same thing, and they're doing the same thing as we speak. And so I said, I want more for my son because I want him to have the best kind of life. And all the experts were telling me that this is what he needed was all these, you know, therapies to, you know, make him, you know, do whatever, walk, you know, feed himself, all those, you know, things. But so I did it, and we did more. And so therapy and services kind of, you know, took over our lives. And I jokingly say that, you know, had they given awards for it, I would have won Therapy Mom of the Year. I mean, I got the therapist catalog, and I got my credit card, and I bought the big orange therapy ball that, you know, didn't even fit through the front door until you deflated. And I moved the furniture out, and I put the yellow therapy benches and the mauve-colored four-wheel rolling stool the therapist used. And all the professionals in our lives, you know, patted me on the shoulder and said, oh, Kathy, you are such a good mom. Boy, we wish we had more parents like you, you know. And so, you know, here I am. Yes, aren't I a good mother? But then I quickly realized that I didn't like the way our lives were going. And, you know, some people would say, oh, well, yeah, because you had a child with a disability. That's why you liked the way your life was like. But that wasn't it. Because I realized, and it took me a long time to realize this, is that the day after my son was diagnosed, he was no different than he was the day before. He didn't change. I changed. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw him like a child with cerebral palsy. You know, I treated him like a child with cerebral palsy. In my mind, he became a child with cerebral palsy. So it wasn't the diagnosis that changed our lives. It was the actions that I took. It was me, and again, I didn't know any better at the time. And I try to tell people, you know, every single one of us has done the best we knew to do at that moment in time. So, you know, had I to do it over again, I would do things differently. But again, I was doing the best I knew at the time. But I just knew that I didn't like the way our lives were going, not because Benjamin had cerebral palsy, because he wasn't any different, but because of how our lives had changed, because services, all these therapies and interventions, of course they took over Benjamin's, you know, I mean, he was a little baby. They took over his life, but they took over his sister's life. They took over my life. They took over my husband's life. They took over our family's life. So what I did, in short, was I said, we're not going to do any more. And so I, you know, we didn't cut back any. It's just that all the professionals had realized that, you know, in my vernacular, I was sort of a pasty. Whatever they said that they would offer in the way of services, I would say, we'll do more. So I just said, no, we're not going to do more. And they'd say, oh, but Kathy, they wagged their fingers at me. But if you care about Benjamin, he is at such risk. If you want what's best for him, and I'd say, no, we're just going to hold what we got. Well, moving on, make a long story short, I got, my son was 3 by this time, and we were still doing lots of therapy and stuff, but I was trying to, you know, make sure that he was living more of a real life, but didn't know exactly what to do. And so I got into a leadership development training program, which they have in many, many states, and it's called Partners in Policy Making. And the whole idea is to teach people with disabilities and family members how to become partners in the whole field of policymaking and you know, create systems change. And so in this class, there were people with disabilities as well as parents of young children like myself. And I got to know these adults with disabilities who I had never met before. And I quickly realized that the real experts in the hierarchy of experts in this field, the real experts are children and adults with disabilities because they live it. And I tell people, you know, no disrespect to those of you that are working in the field, but for you, it's a job, and you can go find another job, and, you know, you don't have to choose to work in this field. And granted, you might feel like it's your life because maybe you work 80 hours a week, but the reality is it is a job. But that's not the same for people with disabilities. It's not their job. It's their life. And so then I realized that the second level of experts were parents, and then everybody else comes under them. So I got to know these adults with disabilities, and they changed my life. I mean, the class changed my life, but getting to know them, and there were a couple in my class. They were men that had cerebral palsy, and I realized in meeting them that my little 3-year-old son was going to grow up to be a man with cerebral palsy, because the sort of the unspoken message that we as parents are given, especially when our children are very young, is it's sort of an unspoken message that we are led to believe that if we do enough therapies and interventions and do all these things, that one of these days our children will not have whatever, you know, autism, cerebral palsy, you know, whatever it is. And mm-hmm. then you meet adults and you say, oh, no, we still have adults with disabilities, you know. Like, you know, do these therapies, are these things supposed to cure somebody, you know? So I got to know these folks, and I... What they said to me was made me uncomfortable. And so when I tell a similar story in my presentations, I tell people, and you know, we'll tell your listeners that some of what I say might make some of you uncomfortable, but I realize that that's a good thing, because we usually only change when we're made to feel uncomfortable in some way, whether we feel, you know, passion, sadness, anger, frustration, fear, you know, whatever. Then we say, oh, wow, we better do things differently. So what I learned from them, you know, I talked to them, I said, well, what was it like when you were children? And they would say stuff to me like, well, you know, I think I'm a big disappointment to my mom and dad. And I said, well, why would you say that? Mm-hmm. You know, what makes you say that? Well, you know, like, my mom took me to therapy all my life, so I learned how to walk. And it must have been really important to her, because sometimes my brother and sister got mad because my mom spent more time with me taking me to therapy. So I know it was really important to her. But anyway, I was never able to walk. And so I think I probably disappointed my mom and dad. Mm. Well, that is shocking to me. And I was thinking, my gosh, does my little son feel like that? You know? But I thought, oh, what do these people know? At the time, I thought, they're just people with disabilities. I got all these experts telling me, you know, therapy, intervention, all this kind of stuff. Well, you know, the months went on. I got to know them better. And ultimately, I mean, what I learned from them was what the message of therapy and interventions are to a person with disability, especially to a young child. And the message is, you're not okay the way you are.
Mm-hmm.
We want to change you. Now, granted, somebody said, well, oh, Kathy, that's not what we mean. You know, and I said, it doesn't matter what the intention is. It matters what the feeling is for the person on the receiving end. And so that's what they helped me learn. That the message is, you're not okay the way you are. And we send that mm-hmm. message over and over and over again every time we, you know, drive a kid to a therapy clinic or have a therapist come to our house. So ultimately, they would say to me, you know, Kathy, I wish my mom and dad could have loved me just the way I am.
Mm.
And so I was just like, you know, just so impacted. But I still didn't really know what to do, and because I thought, you know, what do I do? I mean, I got these people over here telling me this, and, you know, so we just kind of held what we got. Well, life goes on. by this time we lived native Texans, we moved to Colorado, and one of the things that I've learned in the Partners Program is that segregating people with disabilities is morally and ethically wrong. I mean, you know, forget about the legal issues for a minute, but segregation is morally and ethically wrong. So I did not send Benjamin to a special preschool, which most of them, unfortunately, not all, but most of them are segregated places just for kids with disabilities. And I thought, it wasn't that I didn't want my son with those kids. I didn't think any of those kids should have been there. They should have been home with their mom or in a neighborhood preschool. So we enrolled Benjamin in a neighborhood preschool, and you know, people always think, oh, I make it sound so easy. It wasn't always easy, but the point is you do it anyway. And so Benjamin went to a neighborhood preschool, and by now he's in kindergarten, and the wonderful little town we lived in had this fantastic inclusive elementary school. You know, this was back in, it was already an inclusive school when we got there, you know, back in the late 80s, and so this was in the early 90s. And so Benjamin, by now, is in first grade, and he's kind of got, you know, one foot in what I call disability world, and that's the world of services and segregation and, you know, special and all that nonsense. And so he's got one foot in disability world because he's still going off therapy after school, and he's got one foot in the real world because he's included in school. He's with, you know, he's going to school, you know, with, you know, kids who don't have disabilities. He's included in all regular classrooms, as were all the other kids. And we enrolled him in Cub Scouts, and he wanted to play T-ball because his friend would do it. So, you know, he had a little manual wheelchair, and we got him a little adapted bat, and he played, you know, played T-ball. So, you know, life's pretty grand. Well, one day, he's in first grade, and I've got all these kids in the carpool driving him home, and Benjamin, you know, I put his wheelchair in the back and put him up in the booster seat in the front. And these little kids in the back were saying, oh, when I get home, I'm going to go play Nintendo. And they'd say, oh, when I get home, my mom's taking me to ballet class. And they'd say, Benjamin, what are you going to do? And he looked over at me, and he says, Mommy, what day is it? And if I said Tuesday or Thursday, he said, well, I got to go to therapy. And he started saying, Mommy, I don't want to go to therapy. And I know, honey, but you got to go, you know, because, like, you know, that's what you do. You got cerebral palsy, you're supposed to go to therapy. And so this went on for about 6 weeks, and one day he just exploded, and he just was in tears and was just in a rage, and was just, you know, tears running down his face. And he says, Mommy, he says, I don't want to go to therapy. He says, I've been going all my life. And I thought, how incredibly sad that a six-year-old kid could say they've been doing anything all their lives, you know. And mm-hmm. and he says, Mommy, he says, going to therapy doesn't make me feel like a regular person. And I mean, he was screaming it at me, and I can't scream it out over the phone at an interview. But I was just like, I thought, my God, he's telling me the same thing that those adults had told me 3 years before, and I didn't listen. But thank God their voices were in my head, because then when my son told me that, then their voices rose up. And so Benjamin never went back to therapy. And some people, of course, read the riot act to me and said I was throwing away the last 6 years of his life, and if I had to take the therapy, he'd get this and this. And so what I realized was that he needed assistance with certain things, but he didn't need to go to therapy. And so it's not that I didn't need a therapist. I needed him in a different way. I needed him as consultants. And they had actually taught me a whole lot of stuff. And I just asked Benjamin, I said, Benjamin, I said, do you still want to watch TV and use the remote control and play on the computer? And so he said, yeah, Mommy. And I said, okay, because his head would be down all the time, the way the CP affects him. His shoulders are rounded or pulled in, his hands are tucked into his body, his head's down. You know, he can't do much when you're like that. So I said, well, I said, if you want to do those things, then we still got to, you know, help you with your body some stuff. And he said, okay, Mommy. He says, but no home programs. You know, because I tell parents, kids don't want their parents to be therapists. They want them to be mom and dad. So we found the most natural ways of helping Benjamin, because I realized that we oftentimes try to help people with disabilities in the most unnatural ways possible. You know, sitting there watching your favorite TV show, oh, I'm going to stop that, I'm going to make you go to therapy, I'm going to work on your body, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So we just found more natural ways of helping Benjamin using some of the techniques that I'd learned from the therapist. But now Benjamin was in control. And so, you know, at night I'd go to undress him or dress him in the morning, and I'd say, Benjamin, you know, how about a shoulder massage? So, you know, it's like, would anybody turn down a shoulder massage? So instead of taking the therapy once a week for range of motion exercises, we do a shoulder massage. And instead of getting in the hot tub and doing water therapy, he and his dad would get in the hot tub and they'd play. And Mark would chase him around the pool, and Vince would dive to the bottom, and, you know, he got all... I mean, so the point is that, you know, we needed... People with disabilities might need certain assistance in doing certain things, but there's all kinds of ways to do it. Well, what went on from there was that we started living a different life, and that's the day that I tell people that we got out of disability world, that we stopped letting Benjamin's disability be the most important thing about him. Well, in the meantime, the people at the Partners Program invited me to come back and speak at the next class, and I was not a public speaker. I was, quote-unquote, just a mom, and my knees were not, and I'm sure I stumbled and made all kinds of mistakes, but I guess I did okay, because the person in charge started referring me to other people, and so people started calling me and inviting me to present, and they said, well, how much do you charge? And I said, you're going to pay me? I mean, it's like, you know, you're going to pay me? So I was like, all of a sudden, I became a public speaker. I never intended to do that, but it just happened out of passion. And so then after being, you know, doing just public speaking for a number of years, I would realize I'd be doing a presentation and that I have a, you know, a two-hour presentation or three-hour presentation or even an all-day presentation. And I thought, ooh, there's still more that I wanted to share with people. I didn't have enough time. And so I thought, well, I got to put it in a book. So so that's how I wrote the first edition of the book in 2001, and it's called Disability is Natural Revolutionary Common Sense for Raising Successful Children with Disabilities. And it's not about getting more services. In fact, it's just the opposite. It's how do we help children live real lives? How do we get them whatever assistance that they need to do what they want to do and make sure that they're included in living the same kind of lives that they were born to live, the same kind of lives as their brothers and sisters and anybody. And so then, you know, once the book came out, so my public speaking increased just by word of mouth. And then once the book came out, then that caused it. So things have just grown, you know, just by sort of naturally. I don't do any really marketing of my presentations. Of course, I market the book on the website, but it just sort of happened. It's just, I think that people are ready. I mean, I think if people were not ready to hear a new message, I wouldn't have the business that I have. So I think that
A lot of what you said, I mean, you touched my heart. You brought back a lot of memories listening to you, because I'm sure, as Cindy told you, I was born with cerebral palsy myself. And as far as inclusion, I remember when I was going into first grade, Kathy, and my mom went to register me for school. And she said, well, you know, my daughter happens to have cerebral palsy, but, you know, she's fine and whatever. And I was sitting right there. And I went to a Catholic school, and her sister looked at my mother, and she said, well, your daughter doesn't belong here. She needs to go to a special school.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at...
How old are you now, Josie? So when did this take place?
I'm 42. So,
okay.
This was in the early 70s.
Okay.
When I was going into first grade. But to make a long story short, my mom, of course, was really upset, and she contacted United Cerebral Palsy, and she told them what happened. The executive director called the school and told them, no, she's fine. She doesn't need to be in a special school. She'll be just fine. And back and forth, they finally allowed me to go to school.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was my first experience.
Josie, the word that you use, that they allowed you. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
You know,
that's how I felt.
Well, and what I realized years ago is that every person, and I try to share this in my book and presentations, that every person, I mean, we live in a society where every person is born included. You know, we don't live in a society where there's a caste system, or, you know, you're the untouchables, or where you're born to royalty or serfdom, you know, those.
Right.
I mean, everybody in our, and the only way that people become excluded is not because they have disabilities. I mean, some people think that, but it's because of what we do. And I say we as parents, or we as educators, or we as a society, you know, we take actions that cause people to move out of that natural state of being included. And we make them segregated.
You know, that exactly what you're saying here. Yesterday, I have a pen pal that I'm currently in California right now, and I'm from Connecticut. I live in Connecticut. A gal got a hold of me via my website who is a quadriplegic. She just is injured for a little over a year, and I had the pleasure of meeting her face to face yesterday, and we got to talking, and she said, you know, one of the hardest things for her, she seems pretty at ease, well, not at ease, but, you know, pretty close to accepting where she was at. And she said, one of the things that's really hard for me is my husband keeps saying, you need to go to the Christopher Reeve Her husband, my pen pal's husband, keeps telling her that she needs to, you know, she'll walk again, don't give up, blah, 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 blah. And that's the hardest part for her, is that she feels as though she's letting him down. And do you still love me? And am I going to be enough if I don't walk again?
Right.
You know,
well, and that's why, and I, this, you know, some people would disagree with what I'm about to say, but when Christopher Reeve had his accident, and my son always loved Superman as a little boy, and when Christopher Reeve had his accident, of course, you know, I was sorry that anybody has any kind of accident, but at the same time, I thought, oh, good, I thought, you know, maybe now we'll have a spokesperson, you know, and Christopher Reeve was such a disappointment to me, in the sense that his whole thing was that he would walk again, you know.
Yeah.
That he did not accept himself. That it was okay to be a person who uses a wheelchair, you know.
Right.
That you don't have to walk to have a good life, you know.
Right.
You don't have to talk to have a good life. I mean, you do need the tools. You need a wheelchair to get you where you want to go, and hopefully if you can't wheel yourself, you need a power wheelchair so that you can go into your own power. And if you don't talk, you need a communication device so that you can, you know, state your wants and needs and, you know, tell people hi or goodbye or, you know, whatever you want to tell them. You know, so it's not about functional skills. And what the young woman you're talking about, Cindy, I think that what we've embraced, unfortunately, is the medical model. And mm-hmm. the medical model works for ordinary things. If you've got a strep throat, you go to the doctor, you say, you essentially say, I have a problem, I want you to fix it. And mm-hmm. so the medical model works if you have strep throat or cancer or diabetes. Those are indeed illnesses. But disabilities are not in and of themselves illnesses. And people with disabilities don't need to be fixed, you know. They're fine just the way they are. But unfortunately, society's embraced the medical model. We think in terms of what's wrong with the person, what's wrong with you, you know. Well, if it's mm-hmm. something's wrong with you, then we have to fix it to make it right. And it's that old, you know, quote-unquote able-bodied standard that you can walk, talk, feed yourself, you know, read at grade level, you know, all those things. But, and this is where, you know, people like Josie and people with disabilities that I've met and my own son have taught me that it's not about functional abilities. You know, it's not about walking and talking. It's about, are you in charge of your own life? Are you living the kind of life that you want? You know, do you have those tools and accommodations and supports that all of us use? I mean, we tend to think that these things are somehow special, you know, and I hate that special needs term. It's like, it's so derogatory. It's so, you know, it perpetuates just its negative stereotypes and low expectations and stuff. But all of us use assistive technology. I mean, you know, I ask people, how many of you would get rid of your BlackBerry or your, you know, your date timer, your, you know, I mean, we all use assistive technology devices. We all use supports. We all use modifications, you know. Mm-hmm. What we've done is we have not provided those to people with disabilities, so then we make them look incompetent, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, it's all about who we are, you know. I mean, I always say that I would not change anything about my life, and I mean
right.
that sincerely, because
right.
it's who I am. And if I wasn't born with cerebral palsy and if I didn't have a hearing impairment, I wouldn't be the strong person that I am today.
That's right. That's right.
I'm just saying it took me a long time to realize that because
right.
of all these things that society puts in your head, and like you were
right.
saying before, that there's something wrong with us, but there's
right.
nothing wrong with us. We just happen to have a disability.
Right. And I define, you know, on my website, on my presentations and articles, especially there's on my website is a people first language article. And by the way, there's a lot of articles on my website that, you know, disabilitiesnatural.com that anybody can go on and download them and make copies of them and share with others. But that, you know, we redefine disability as just a body part that works differently, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my son's legs work differently and sometimes his hands work differently. And the inspiration for the name of the book actually came from a federal law that I first heard about when my son was 3, and that began changing me. It took me a while to change to where I am now. But the DD Act, the Developmental Disabilities Act, that was first passed in the mid-1970s, says that disability is a natural part of the human experience. And it goes on to say, therefore, people with disabilities should not be, you know, exempted from, you know, responsibility and inclusion and integration and productivity and, in other words, to live the same kind of lives as everybody else. And so if you think about that, that disability is a natural part of life, that, you know, and I'll tell a group in an audience when I'm doing a presentation that those of you that, you know, do not presently have disabilities, if you live long enough, you will. You know, you'll have a disability through an accident, an illness, or the aging process. And, of course, the longer we live, the more, you know, chance of disability we're going to have, so that people with disabilities constitute the largest minority group in this country. And it's the only 20% of all Americans have a disability. And it's the only minority group that anybody can join at any time. It's the most inclusive. It includes people of, you know, I mean, all genders, races, ethnic backgrounds, religion, socioeconomic, you know, sexual orientation, everything. It's inclusive, you know. So, but we all ought to care about disability issues.
It's the most inclusive, yet it's the least recognized. You know,
I'm sorry, say
social.
I'm having your voices are kind of going in and out. If you speak up,
I'm sorry. It is the most inclusive, but it's the least recognized.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well,
and
I'm always disturbed when I'll get an email or hear about a conference on diversity, you know, diversity conference, and they're going to have speakers talking about women and gender and ethnic backgrounds and you know, sexual orientation and religion and age, and I'll say, hey, where's disability in there?
Uh-huh.
You know, like, people are still almost invisible.
Right.
I think that people are afraid of it. I really do. You know, like when you, I still say that being hearing impaired for me is harder than having a disability like CP, because people don't know that I am hearing impaired. And when I don't understand and they have to repeat something, they get all flustered and you know, they don't know how to deal with it. Like something's
right.
wrong with me.
Right, right. Well, and
but
I
love the
that,
word. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Oh,
about
I think it is that comfort level. It, you know, we constantly seek a comfort level. Like water, we want to stay in the same place all the time. You know, and
mm-hmm.
so getting people out of their comfort zone. But I mean, what I've realized is, you know, some people will say, you know, especially with parents or, you know, or science professionals in the field that work with adults, and they'll say, oh, no, well, the community is not ready for people with disabilities. And I say, of course it is. The community's always been ready, and people with disabilities have always been ready. And the way that we make inclusion happen for everybody is to make sure that people with disabilities are out there doing stuff, that all the things that my son has been involved in, I mean, when he took, you know, when he was in a T-ball class, and then later he took karate lessons, and but then he had a power wheelchair, and people would say, well, how can he take karate? He doesn't walk. And I said, oh, that's easy. He's got his power wheelchair. I said, do you think he ever loses a match? I mean, you know, he'll just mow you down. I mean, he won, you know, high key, he won. And he took drama lessons and all the things that he's ever done. I tell people that this Benjamin's, and this will be true of you, Josie, or anybody else with a disability, that Benjamin's physical presence in those environments has taught more people than I can ever do. Because people, yes, at first are a little bit uncomfortable, and sometimes like first, and Josie, you probably experienced this. I mean, I don't know if you use a wheelchair or not, but people that use wheelchairs, it's like somehow that they think that if you use a wheelchair, you also can't think and you can't hear. So they'll talk
right.
real loudly and slowly, you know.
Absolutely.
And then once they get to know Benjamin, they realize, oh, this is what he needs, this is what he doesn't need, you know. And then they get to know him beyond a disability. And so, you know, the most important thing that any of us can do is make sure that people with disabilities are out there doing those ordinary things, and then the fear and the discomfort, you know, goes away.
Excuse me, I have to interrupt, guys. We're right at the time we're going to take a break, but I do want to come back and talk a little bit about Benjamin and some of the things he's accomplished.
Okay.
So let's go ahead and have a break, and we'll come back in a minute or two and allow our listeners to go get a cup of coffee or run to the restroom, whatever. About Benjamin, and I read on the internet, Kathy, that Benjamin is now doing films and all kinds of stuff. He's quite an amazing man, and you know, obviously, you had a little bit to do with that. Can you tell us a little bit about Benjamin?
Sure, and yes, I'm an extremely proud mother. He's 21, and he is attending college right now. He's taking classes at Pikes Peak Community College, which is close to us. It was about an hour away in Colorado. And he wants to major in film and journalism. He wants to be the next Roger Ebert. He wants to be a film critic. And as a result, he's grown up loving movies. That was just always a thing of his. And he's always had a flair for the dramatic. When he was very young, he loved Thomas the Tank Engine, and he knew all the storylines. He had all the books and watched all the videos. And so he would write his own Thomas the Tank Engine plays, and we would all have to sit around the table and we'd have to read our parts. And of course his sister used to drive his sister wild. I don't want to be Gordon the big ant. You know, and she'd say, do it, you know. So I'd say, you have to do it. You know, we do stuff you want. Now you got to do stuff your brother wants. And so he's always had this flair for the dramatic. And then as I said, he took drama lessons for a while, and he used to want to be an actor. And he'd say, Mom, I want to be the first James Bond that uses a power wheelchair. So he wanted me to put rocket propelled grenades on his chair and, you know, all this kind of stuff. He wanted his chair to be like James Bond's car. And so he went, now wants to be a film critic. He's very serious. He's done some writing for his college newspaper. And in 2006, I heard about a film contest, and this was not a, you know, quote-unquote disability thing. This was just a film contest for any person ages 18 to 26 to, it was called Film Your Issue, and it was to, you know, an invitation for young people to make a short film, and I mean short, like 30 to 60 seconds, like a TV commercial, basically, on something they felt passionate about. And so Benjamin made a film because of his love of movies and because, of course, partly because he's who he is being my son and how he feels about himself. And, you know, he knows he has cerebral palsy. He's like, what's the big deal? Get on with it. You know, so I guess not the most important thing about it. Kind of like in Josie's life. And so he made a film called Thumbs Down to Pity, of course, taking the thing of thumbs up or thumbs down like the film critics do it. And so he...
I saw it. It's wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I mean, and the message is, and people can go on my website and see it. You can, you know, look at it right there. But the message was that people with disabilities are portrayed in movies with pity. And that's what perpetuates these continued, you know, negative stereotypes. And so his message is, you know, to filmmakers, you know, stop doing the stereotypes. Well, he submitted the film, and it got picked to be one of the 35 semifinalists, and then he won. He was one of the five national winners. And
wow.
So one of the awards was they got new computers and new cell phones and all kinds of stuff. Young people like it. And then they got a trip to the United Nations, which was one of the sponsors. And so, you know, I told Benjamin, I said, I'm 56 years old. I've never been to the United Nations, and I'm, you know, riding your coattails, baby. And so then it was shown at Sundance. So we went to Sundance Film Festival with him. And, you know, so he's leading the charge here, you know. And the thing is that, you know, not every person has to go out and make a film and win an award. But the point is that, you know, we, especially those of us that are parents, we need to get our kids out there and get them doing the same kinds of things. You know, whatever they're interested in, say, well, you know, we don't know how it's going to work, but we'll find a way to make it happen. And that's sort of our attitude. It's just, you know, what does it take?
Yeah. It's also getting through the society's preconceived beliefs and reaching out to the community. And I would love to talk to Benjamin a little bit more about his own experiences with cerebral palsy, and maybe one of these days we could.
Oh, that would be
great.
He would love that. He would love
that.
Yeah,
and also,
Josie,
you know,
he feels the same way that you do, and I feel the same way. There's not one thing I would change about Benjamin. Not one thing. I mean, you know, I had a radio interviewer ask me one time, and, you know, well, if there was a magic pill, you wouldn't give it to your son? And I said, no, you know. And he said, well, how does your son feel about that? And Benjamin was sitting here, little Mr. Big Ears, he was sitting listening to my end of the conversation, and I said, well, I'll ask him. And so I asked him, I said, Benjamin, you know, we gave you a pill, you wouldn't have cerebral palsy, you want to take it? And he said, no, he just screamed across the room, no, don't you get it? You know.
You know what, though? That's awesome. And he's very lucky to have such an encouraging, insightful woman as a mother who can...
He sure is.
Oh.
You're very
you know,
nice,
Kathy,
Cindy,
I don't know if you guys
have
ever heard...
I feel like I'm the lucky one, actually.
Yeah.
Scott Hamilton, the skater, I remember once he said, the only disability in life is a bad attitude.
Oh, that's a good thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and I love it because it is all about attitude, and Kathy, you have the right attitude.
Well, and I try to tell folks, you know, whether you're a parent or a teacher or a professional field, say it is never, ever, ever about the person's diagnosis, because that's all a disability is. It's a medical diagnosis. So it's never about their diagnosis. It's about us and our attitudes, you know.
And you know what else I found extremely interesting with what you said at the beginning of our conversation? You said the day after his diagnosis, he was treated differently by you.
Right.
Yeah.
I saw him differently.
Yeah.
You know, I had to go back and rechange that and realize, no, he's the same person. He's the same little baby that he was born as, that we had those same big hopes and dreams for him, you know.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to let that disability label, you know, get in the way of having those same hopes and dreams, you know.
Beautiful.
And I was telling this story one time, and a mother in the audience said to me, I mean, it was like sort of the thing that you read at the beginning, Josie, on that, for the rave reviews page. This mom,
okay.
And I put her in the second edition of my book, but... because what didn't happen in the first edition was written, but she started crying in one of the presentations I did, and afterwards she came up to me and she said, Kathy, she says, my gosh, she says, the day that my daughter was diagnosed, she says, from that day forward, every time I look at her, I see the word autism tattooed on her forehead.
Oh.
And she said, I can't believe I've done that to my daughter. You know, and she recognized that she had done that, you know. And that's what, part of it is us taking responsibility for our attitudes. And anyway, that day, I mean, she had an epiphany, and that's one of the greatest joys of my job is to, you know, have people come up and tell me, wow, I'm going to leave here and I'm a different person. And again, it's not me. I mean, other people could say, you know, you haven't changed my mind at all. So it's not me, it's them. It's the decisions they made. But she said, I'm going to take the word autism out of my vocabulary. I mean, she goes, yes, it's my daughter's medical diagnosis, but it's not who she is, you know.
You know, that brings me also to another thing, and Josie and I were talking about this earlier without you on this phone call, but you have something called person first.
Yeah, the people first language.
Person first language. And you know, I know a little bit about that, but can you tell our listeners what you mean by person first language?
Well, it's putting the person before the disability, because historically, people with disabilities have been known by their diagnoses, so that they're called, quote-unquote, the retarded or the autistic or, you know, the wheelchair-bound or, you know, those kinds of, you know, demeaning terms. And I did not create people-first language. I wish I was smart enough to do that. It was created back in the 1970s, actually, and it first came out of the Scandinavian countries, and then it went to Canada, and then it went to Oregon through conferences, and then it spread across the United States back in the 70s, but it's been slow to catch on. But it was people with disabilities that created it. Specifically, it was people with, you know, what I would call a cognitive disability. I mean, the old term would be the, you know, mental retardation, which that's a very pejorative term. But it was people that, you know, were said to have, quote-unquote, low IQs who said, and they created a movement. It was called, you know, it's called variously the People First Movement or the Self-Advocacy Movement, in which it was young adults with disabilities who said, you know, they said two things. Number one, we can speak for ourselves, meaning we don't need our parents or professionals speaking for us. We can, you know, we want to live our own lives. And they also said, we are not our disabilities. We are people first. So using people first language means that you would put person before you put the disability. So a person, like, has quadriplegia or has cerebral palsy or has autism or, you know, has Down syndrome, as opposed to, you know, I mean, I still meet parents today that they'll say, oh, yeah, I have a Downs kid. You know, it's like, no, you don't. You have a child. And what's the child's name? The child's name is Tommy. And Tommy is 5, and Tommy happens to have Down syndrome, you know.
Right.
It's not the most important thing about him.
No,
he has
it. It isn't him.
Probably.
Yeah.
Right. I always say that my cerebral does not define me.
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not the most. And what I said earlier about a disability is essentially just a medical diagnosis. And just like I don't go sharing my medical diagnosis with every Tom, Dick, and Harry, you know.
Right.
I don't sit there and I say, oh, hi, I'm Kathy. I've had a hysterectomy, you know. I mean, she's
right.
Like, you know, I mean, hopefully people would say, Kathy, that's too much information, you know. But unfortunately, we don't apply that to people with disabilities. We think that if we know the diagnosis, we think we know the person. But just like, you know, Josie and my son share the same diagnosis, they're not anything alike, you know. They share some of the same experiences of being discriminated against. But, you know,
right.
As human beings, they're, I mean, just like two women have had a hysterectomy, they're not alike, you know, even though they have the same diagnosis, you know.
Well, obviously, there's been a lot of positive changes over the years. But what do you think still needs to be changed, Kathy?
Well, I mean, one thing that needs to be changed, of course, is the system. And by that, I mean the entire system. I use that very globally, that, you know, everything from, you know, government services and assistance to special education. And the biggest thing that I think needs to be changed is that, I mean, people with disabilities, and we as parents learn this, and Josie, you were born at a time when this wasn't in existence, but shortly thereafter it started, of things like early intervention for very young children. We learn that there, what we learn is that the system, I mean, and it's a myth, but we don't know it's a myth, that what we're told, go to the system has all the answers, go to the professionals, which is not much different from what we did in the institutional era when parents are told to put their babies with disabilities in an institution and forget they were ever born. Well, we don't have institutions so much anymore, although there's still some in existence. But we still are told, essentially, you are not competent to raise this child. You know, you're not the expert. We are, you know, so get into the system, get an intervention, get special preschools, get special education, you know, get voc rehab. Well, the big ugly picture is, I mean, the bad news is that we have an estimated, you know, 75, you know, depending on which percentage of people you ask, 75 to 95%. Unemployment rate of people with disabilities. So I look at that as the big outcome, and I say, well, the system's not working for people. And so my mantra is that the system, you know, whatever it is, whatever piece of the system it is, the system ought to be the last resort and never the first choice. And so from the time my son stopped going to therapy at age 6, he does not receive any special services. You know, he doesn't want them. You know, we told him, I mean, that's his decision, and then we back him up. And, you know, we said, if at some point you ever need, you know, government assistance, it'll always be there for you. But why do you want to go there and give up your autonomy and your privacy and your self-respect and your pride unless you absolutely have to? So that, to me, Josie, is what needs to change, that we need to get out of this, you know, sort of brainwashed mentality that if you have a disability, you should automatically go into the system. I mean, going into the system is a choice.
Do you think the ADA has made a difference?
Not significantly, no. I mean, I'm glad we have it. And I'm glad that with new construction, you know, and they, you know, to have to retrofit something. I'm obviously glad we have it. It's made a huge difference in public access. I think that's the greatest impact it's had, and, you know, being able to go to a mall or find a wheelchair-accessible, you know, restroom. But it has not made any significant difference in the unemployment rate.
No,
and it's not made any significant
that.
Difference in people's disabilities being dependent on, you know, government assistance.
Well, I'll tell you, son, that I am also a former journalist, so I understand.
Well, he might have to write you, Josie, and get some wisdom from you.
Well, sure, I'd be happy. I'd be happy to talk to him about it.
But when
I first went to my first interview, I was told to get out of the field because I wasn't going to make it.
And look at you now, right?
You know, we still have a lot of attitudes to change, so I really commend you on the work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and also it brings back, you know, I'm disabled as well, and my whole point is that I feel, you know, that we're living in a society that's so unaware, and that's where the freedom of travel comes in, and this is where I think Benjamin would be such a great part of it, is that it's an attitude, and we want to take away the fear. Let's remove it. Let's introduce this differently, you know. And that's
right.
How he is in the world. Here I am. What are you afraid of, people? You know, it's just lack of knowing. So
right.
I think.
Well, and it is.
It's
a fear based on ignorance. Not, I mean, stupidity, but I mean ignorance. Just like I was ignorant until. I mean, what did I know about this until my son was born? You know, and I am so grateful that I've had the life that I've had. I mean, if I did not have Benjamin and he didn't have, you know, the disability that he has, I wouldn't know what I know today. You know, I wouldn't have had the experience. I wouldn't be talking to you on the phone. You wouldn't be calling
right.
me, you know.
Right.
So I look at all the wonderful experiences that Benjamin and his, you know, having a disability have brought to us, and it's enriched our lives.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely. And I think that's almost maybe it takes a while, especially for newly injured people, to come to grips with their new way of being, but it really has opened my eyes to important things in life, and it's actually brought a lot of meaning to every day
absolutely.
I live, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's enabled me to meet people and do stuff, and I mean, again, I look at my son, and I think about, and I mean, Josie, you're an example too, and Sydney, both of you, that the number of people that, so for example, you know, my son, and again, many other people, you know, like him, that the number of people that he's had such a positive influence on, you know, that I mean, there are, you know, when once your kids get out of elementary school, you don't see other parents holding them, and the kids are little, you go into PTA meetings, all that kind of stuff. And I saw this man recently that our kids were in elementary school together, and you know, again, Benjamin was included. He was just one of the other kids, and you know, his classmates learned that, okay, Benjamin had a walker and a wheelchair and other adaptive devices, and he might do stuff a little bit differently. He didn't write with a pencil, so they got him a computer and stuff. And it was like not a big deal to the kids. And I saw this man the other day, and you know, his daughter's off to college, and we ran into each other, and he says, "My gosh, Kathy," he says, "and I haven't seen you in so long." And he says, "You know," he says, "I just want to tell you, you know, it's like 18 years ago, or you know, 15 years ago, whatever." He says, "How fantastic it was that our kids were in second grade together." He said, "Your son changed our daughter's life, and in turn, our daughter changed our family's life because of knowing Benjamin." You know,
mm-hmm.
So it's like there's so many good things that can happen if we'll allow them to happen.
Yeah. If we just what
advice do you have for parents out there who have children who happen to be disabled?
That they need to have the same dreams they had before their child was diagnosed, because the child is the same person, and they need to believe in their child and dream with their child, so that their child can then in turn dream for themselves, you know, and to never crush a child's hopes and dreams. That no matter what Benjamin has said he wanted to do in his life, you know, from the time he was a little bitty kid to now, whatever he said, I'll say fine. Because number one, I know he's going to change his mind, especially when they're little, they change their minds, you know. But I would have professionals tell me, I mean, Benjamin used to say when he was little he wanted to be a doctor, because he had to see a lot of doctors when he was little, you know. And so he one day he said he wanted to be a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, like this doctor that he went to. And I had an occupational therapist, I mean, this was whenever we were still doing all the therapy, you know, tell me, well, you shouldn't let Benjamin think like that, because he'll never be a doctor, you know. And I said, well, how do you know? Well, because he has cerebral palsy, and people say, well, you know, they can't be doctors. And I said, well, is that a law somewhere? I never read that law, you know. It's like, and I told her, I said, you know what? I said, no one has got the right to steal my son's dreams. And
that
I said, if Benjamin, whenever he's an adult, if he really does want to be a doctor, then he'll figure out how to be a doctor. And I said, but it's up to him to figure out if that's inappropriate for him. And I said, it's not up to me to say, Benjamin, you can't do that. Because I realized that, you know, if you crush a person's hopes once, you crush them forever. Because the child will always be fearful of them and never wanting to come back to you and say they want to be something else because they're going to be afraid that you'll say they can't do that too, you know. Mm. So we have to trust our kids. I mean, I trust Benjamin to know he knows his body and what he can do better than I do, you know, mm-hmm. even as a young child. They know themselves. I mean, you know, Josie, you've known your body better than your mom ever did, you know.
Right.
It's your body. And so we have to trust people to know that they'll figure it out, you know. And we have to believe in them.
Hey, I can
sit here. Believe in people.
I could sit here and listen to you, and I'm sure you feel the same way, Josie, all day long.
I do.
Sure you have so many more beautiful things, loving and giving advice for all of us. I really hate to cut you off here, but we're running out of time, unfortunately. And I just wanted to say personally, Kathy, thank you so much for sharing your life and your insight. We need more of you in the world, and I'm hoping maybe one of these days we can have you back on our program because I know you have so much more to give.
Oh, I would love that.
Thank you, Kathy, very much.
Well, thanks to both of you for all that you do because I know you're making a profound and significant and positive difference in the world. So
we just need to hold hands and make it all happen.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. So anyways, to my listeners, you can find her book and her information on Kathy Snow on www.disabilityisnatural.com or on my Freedom to Travel Show site. And remember, listeners, that all this information can be found anywhere on my site. So, or you can go to her Disability is Natural. Also, there's some archives there for other guests and interviews, including Josie's. So the other thing I wanted to remind you to do is mark your calendars. You don't want to miss our next show. We have a gentleman named Jim Troche. He will be airing on May 4th. He's also known as the Hollywood Quad. He's an actor, a writer, and a producer who starred on Michael Landon's Highway to Heaven for like over 3 years as his lawyer. So that ought to be an interesting show. And I just want to send out my blessings to all of you. Remember that we're here every other Sunday on BBS Radio. And don't forget to get out and see the world because you can. There's a whole world waiting for you. What are you waiting for?